Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on whatever happened to the American family farmer right after this message. Hey, if you've got a lot 50 by 100 feet with a 2,000 square foot house on it, you've got space on that lot for 6 raised beds that contain 2,400 square feet. It's called French intensive culture. 2,400 square feet is enough space to grow all of the food that a family of 5 or 6 will eat in one entire year. And you can do it in the middle of a city just as easily as you can out in the country. You see, the idea that you're trapped in the city and you can't provide for yourself and your family because of a space limitation is a fiction. You don't need extra cash to buy a tractor, a plow, or a harrow. What you need is a shovel, a rake, and a hoe. That's more in line with what it is that we need for an urban French intensive culture farm. We don't need lots of acres, combines, or price supports, or the Department of Agriculture. What we need is pruners, newspaper for mulch, and open pollinated seed. Now, if you've got 2,400 square feet or a backyard big enough for a decent garden, you can feed your entire family on your own land. Now, open pollinated seed is designed and it will answer your questions with the most economical and practical solutions to your long-term food needs. It has space-saving vegetables, so you need less land, less fertilizer, less water, less mulch, and less work. And it's been designed with immediate food availability. You know, it only takes 28 days from seed to salad when you're talking about some things like radishes. It has flowers to attract wild pollinators because of the loss of our honeybee population to chemical sprays and disease. You know, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number to call, 417-273-4967. And remember, my subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, why don't you go to the website, it's georgegordon.org, and click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of the American family farmer. Remember, we had 45 million of those critters back in 1920. Today, we've got less than 2 million. We've lost 96% of them. The Department of Agriculture is the cause. It was done by plan. It's purpose. It's intentional. And it succeeded. The Department of Agriculture was never the friend of the American farmer. It wasn't designed that way. It was designed by corporate agribusiness to destroy their competition. And they have succeeded beyond their wildest expectations. The American farmer was destroyed from off of the land not because of corporate agribusiness, but they were destroyed from off the land because they violated 15 agricultural laws. And they were deported. They were removed by the owner of the land. Let me show you that. In Leviticus 25, verse 23, somebody who calls himself God, in Leviticus 25, 23, says, "The land shall not be sold forever, because the land is mine." Listen to this. "The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine, and you're strangers and sojourners with me." Now, you know, just picture it this way. Let's suppose that you've got some ground, and I come to you, and I'm going to be a tenant farmer, and I say, well, I'll give you 25% of what I produce on your ground as rent for the use of your land. And you say, well, okay, Gordon, that's fine. Well, now let's write up a contract here, and let's put some stipulations on here. You see, I want you to let my land rest once every 7 years. Every 50 years, I want a second rest. That's 16 rest times per 100 years. And I don't want you to use chemical fertilizers or pesticides and sprays. And there's a number of rules and regulations that I've got here. Here, take this, look at it. And if you can agree to this, let's sign up. And so I sign the contract. And then you take off and you're gone. And then one day somebody reports to you that I'm using DDT, chemical fertilizers, and I'm letting your fences all fall apart, and I'm clear-cutting all of your timbered land over here. I'm really violating the terms and conditions of our contract. Should I think it's unreasonable of you that you would come back, terminate the contract, and evict me? You know, I really don't think so. I really don't think so. Now, if you'll take a look at this pragmatically, our people 84 generations ago were slaves in Egypt, and we were led out of Egypt by our God. He took us out to Mount Sinai over in Arabia. It's not in Sinai Peninsula, it's over in Arabia. And there was about 3.5 million of us, and your great-great-great-great-great-granddaddy was standing out there, and God pitched him a deal called a tender offer. And in the tender offer, he said, if you will do these things, I will give you these 33 benefits. And he articulated all these benefits. He said, I'll give you rain in due season. Just flip over to Leviticus 26, verses 1 through 13, and he'll tell you, essentially, what these benefits are. You know, he says, I'll give you rain in due season. If you walk in my statutes, the land shall yield or increase. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Your threshing shall reach to the vintage, and the vintage shall reach to the sowing time. You shall eat your bread to the full and dwell in your land safely. I'll give you peace in the land, and you shall lie down, and none shall make you afraid. Hey, do we have peace in the United States of America today? Do we have peace in the land? I was watching TV the other night, and they've turned Washington, D.C. into a fortress. It's an armed camp. You got roadblocks everywhere. And they just stop you and search you and ask you, you know, who you are and where you're going. Kind of reminds you of a German or a Russian police state, doesn't it? You see, I can remember years ago when we used to have peace in our land. Now, our God said, I'll give you peace in the land as long as you're performing under the terms and conditions of our contract. Let's take a look at that. In Leviticus 26, he says, you shall make you no idols nor graven images. That includes the Statue of Liberty and the Washington Monument. And neither shall you rear up a standing image, and neither shall you set up any image of stone in your land to bow down unto it, because I'm the Eternal, your God. And you shall keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary, because I'm the Eternal. And if you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and do them, then here's what I'm going to do for you. You know, it's what we call a quid pro quo tender offer. The tender offer is, you do this and I'll do that. That's the compensator, or the money, or the compensation on the contract. Now, a contract has four elements. It has an offer with an acceptance, over time with consideration. Four elements to a contract. And all contracts are oral. All contracts are oral. The written agreement is the highest and best evidence of the oral agreement. See how simple that is? I'm just giving you a couple of pointers here in law. It doesn't cost you anything to pay attention. Now, the most important thing in a man's life is law. We Americans don't practice much law. We practice politics in this country. Oh, God, people get excited about politics. They get excited about religion, too. Religion and politics. Well, okay, I don't want to get in the way of people's happiness and success, but my point is, in this series of programs, what happened to the American farmer? You know, the farmers out there are blaming Republicans, Democrats, populists, libertarians, communists, socialists, bankers, Jews. I mean, if there's somebody out there to blame, they're blame them. I pointed this out a little earlier. It's in verse 34, Leviticus 26, verse 34. He says, "Then shall the land enjoy your Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate, and you be in your enemy's land. Then shall the land rest and enjoy your Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths when you dwelt upon it." How many of you farmers out there ever practiced a land Sabbath or a Jubilee while you were on the land? Comes up every 7 years. You know, I've been in agriculture since I was 15 years old. I don't ever remember any farmer ever practicing a land Sabbath or a Jubilee. I don't ever remember anybody ever making a redemption of the firstborn. There's 15 of these agricultural laws. Let me run over them for you. It's called the land Sabbath, number one, year of Jubilee, number two, the gleaning law, number three. There's a law concerning cattle interbreeding. Hybrid seed is prohibited. There's a law concerning fruit trees. You can't yoke an ox and an ass together. You can't muzzle an ox who's treading out the corn. Then you have the law of clean and unclean animals, blood and fat law, the law of the redemption of the firstborn, the law of first fruits, the law that prohibits you from seething a kid in its mother's milk, the inheritance law, and the landmark law. 15 statutes, 15 laws that govern agriculture. There's not really much to them. You people in the city aren't in violation of these laws, and you're not paying these penalties. But if you're in agriculture like I am, and you violate one of these laws, there's a penalty. There's 28 penalties that go along with violations of the law. Sometimes it's a capital felony. Now, there's 133 titles of law, and there are 24 of those laws that are punishable by death, you know, like adultery, witchcraft, idolatry. Those are laws that are aimed at capital felonies. But theft isn't punishable by death. It's punishable by restitution. And there's all kinds of laws, statutes, and judgments, and commandments that have other kinds of penalties, like you could be excommunicated, you could be fined, you have to sacrifice, you know, a ram of the first year. Today we call that a fine. It's called a sin offering. You know, in the Bible it's called a sin offering. Today you call it a fine. In ancient times you used to take a ram of the first year down, give it to the priest, and he'd kill it, take the blood and fat and burn it on the altar, cut off the right front shoulder and keep it aside, and send that off to Jefferson City for the Aaronic priesthood, and he'd keep the other 90% of it right there. You know, we practice that to this day. When our judge here in Gainesville takes a $100 fine, he sends $10 to Jefferson City, 10%, a tithe, which is just exactly what the Mosaic law requires, that when a Levitical priest takes a tithe, he sends 10% of it to the Aaronic priesthood. Now, you know, these kinds of customs and practices have been going on in Anglo-Saxon administration now for about 3,000 years. Most people don't know that, or if they know it, they don't know why. They don't know where it came from. Well, now you do. I just told you. And we have two chapters in the Bible, two chapters that deal with judges and the judicial system. We got one big chapter that deals with politics. The political chapter is in Numbers chapter 16. Politics are strictly prohibited. The judicial system is strictly encouraged. In fact, in Exodus chapter 18, you'll find that this is the judicial system with the appellate process that we practice right now, to this day. We practice the appellate process. And there's an instruction in Deuteronomy chapter 1 that instructs judges to judge righteous judgment. But instead of dealing in the judicial system that God instructed us, we've gotten off into politics. And the USDA is a political institution. And Republicans and Democrats are politicians. And they rape us, they rob us, and they pillage us, and they take our property from us, and we're all standing around wondering, why? What happened? We'll stand by, and we'll find out. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, in 1970, the world food supply was 73 days for every man, woman, and child on planet Earth. Today, it's down to less than 38 days. And these global 2,000 mad scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians plan to use famine, disease, plague, and pestilence to reduce Earth's population by 90%, they tell us, over the next 50 years under the Club of Rome plan. Now, you know, back in 1920, nearly 50% of our people lived on the land as subsistence farmers, producing their own food and food for the rest of the world and for you and me. Today, we Americans have chosen to live in the city, and now only 3% of us live on the land. 97% of us then are no longer self-sufficient in our food production. Now, we Americans produce grain for export, all right. Then we turn around and import grapes from Chile, tomatoes from Mexico, berries from Guatemala, and our food supply is now in the hands of foreigners and multinational corporations who support this global 2000 world population control program. And these globalists, with their genocide agenda, have a cause that they're willing to die for. And I say, let them die for their cause, and let you and I live for ours. Now, to learn more, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. My subsistence and survival school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, please go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org. Do it right now before you forget, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Well, last time I pointed out to you this Levitical priesthood in Tennessee. We do the same thing today that was being done 2,000 years ago when Peter cut off the high priest's servant's ear in the Garden of Gethsemane. Furthermore, we're doing the same practices today in our judicial system that we were doing 3,000 years ago or 3,500 years ago with Moses out at Mount Sinai. What we've done is we've changed the names. We no longer call our judges priests or our policemen high priests, but they fulfill that office and they fill that function. Most of us see what's going on around us, but we don't know why it's that way. Let's analyze it a little bit. The Levitical priesthood was the system of judges. They were the civil service in ancient times. They're the people who built the bridges, built the highways, ran the post office, ran the city council, the mayor, the fire department, the police department, collected the taxes. They were, in effect, in essence, in substance, they were the government. God chose one tribe out of 12. We do that today. We select a group of people out of our society to conduct our governmental business. We call them the civil service. In ancient times, we called them the Levitical priesthood, and we divided this priesthood into two distinct organizations. We Americans have these same two distinct organizations. One is called the state judicial system, and the other is called the federal judicial system. The Aaronic priesthood in ancient times, today we call the federal district courts. These priests were judges. They judged us. When we had a controversy, as you read in Exodus chapter 18, the people came to Moses. Jethro came to Moses at the insistence of God and said, "Hey, listen, you can't handle all this by yourself. You need to choose out judges. You need to choose out a group of people who are going to judge these matters." That's why we call them judges to this day. Of course, we have names, you know, we call them magistrates and we call them Supreme Court justices and all kinds of names, but their role is, and the reason that they wear this special garb. And up in Canada, You have a group in your civil service up there that still wear the breastplate. The symbol of a customs inspector in Canada is the breastplate with the 12 spots with the 12 stones on it. Now, where do you people think you got that? They're civil service employees. And they have these same kinds of symbols, and they call these heraldry symbols, signs of our heraldry. Well, let's run through a couple of these. For instance, the policeman today fills the office of the high priest's servant. The high priest's servant was the policeman. They came out to arrest Jesus, remember? And Peter cut off the high priest's servant's ear. Today we'd call that assaulting a policeman. Peter got away with it because Jesus healed his ear. Pretty hard for him to come up and say, hey, this guy cut off my ear. Oh, where's the prima facie evidence? Where's the ear? Where's the stub? Where's the blood? Well, he put it back on and he healed it. Oh, yeah, he cut your ear off a couple hours ago and then he just stuck it back on. Oh, yeah. Crime is what we call it today. In ancient times, we called it sin. Sin is the transgression of the law. So when you violate a law today, we call it a crime. So the old King James writers, they called it sin. That's why we call them sinners. Today we call them criminals. And today, when we put you in jail, in ancient times we put you in ward, or we threw you in the dungeon. We had to put you in a place of restraint to hold you until we could take you into the courthouse, into the courtroom before the judge. Now, in modern parlance, we call this building the courthouse. This courthouse, of course, fills the bill of our public institution. In other words, it's the place where we all go to conduct our public business. It's the place where you go to pay your tithes, your taxes. It's the place that you go to have your property recorded. It's the place that you go to settle controversies with other members of the community. Trial, court, judges. So you got to have an assessor's office and a county recorder's office to record your public business. We call this the courthouse. In ancient times, they called these temples. Public buildings were called temples. And this is where the judges and all the public officials resided. It's where you could go to see the county recorder, the county clerk. And, of course, we have them at the county level, the state level, and at the national level. So did the Romans. So did the Greeks. So did the Israelites. So do we today. Now, when you get into the courthouse, it's got different rooms for different types of business. If you want to pay your taxes, you don't go to the courtroom. If you want a trial, you don't go to the clerk's office. You go to the courtroom, which is called the holy place. It's a holy place because we're going to do some religious business in the holy place called the courtroom. And if you'll take a look at your courtroom, then walk into your church, you'll see that the furnishings of the church and the courtroom are identical. You look over on the right side and you'll see where the choir sits. That's where the jury sits in the courtroom. And the altar in the church is a raised, elevated platform up some steps. Not supposed to be, but that's what they do. They put it on an elevated platform. And you go into the courtroom and there it is, that elevated platform. In court, they call it the bench. In church, they call it the altar. And you got a fence that goes across the middle of the room, and that separates the holy place, where the judge or the priest performs his duties, from the rest of the room where the pews are set, where the people are kept. And the people cannot cross through that bar without permission. You got to have the priest's permission. Now, this priest is called a judge today, but in ancient times he was called a priest. And the higher up he goes, the higher he gets until finally you can get to a high priest. Today we call a high priest an appellate court judge. This judge works at a bench. In ancient times we called this the altar where he does the sacrifices. And you come through the bar, which this bar represents the veil. Do you remember when Jesus died, the veil in the temple was rent in two so that we had access to the Holy of Holies? Now, you can't pass through this bar without an intercessor. This intercessor is called a lawyer today. And he accompanies you up to the altar or the bench where you enter your plea. And this plea is called a prayer. And do you know that in a civil action today, paragraph 20 of a civil complaint is called a prayer for relief? And who are you praying to? You're praying to the priest, who is the intercessor between you and God. And who is your God? It's the United States of America, who pays the judge's salary every Friday. So you come in and you worship your God, the United States of America, or Canada, Australia, New Zealand. You worship your God by obeying the laws of your country, the laws of your God, the law of your sovereign. So worship is the act of obedience to the laws and commands of your God, your sovereign. That's why the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. And in Leviticus 18, verses 1 through 5, God tells you, don't practice the law of Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States. You practice my law. You practice thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And of course, we Americans, we practice adultery, homosexuality, bestiality. We violate all of these laws of God. We have our own law. We practice the Roman civil law, don't we? Then, if you're found guilty of crime or you plead guilty, crime today is a sin, so being guilty of crime is being guilty of sin. This makes you a criminal today. In olden days, you were called a sinner. If you're a criminal, you have to pay the fine. You have to pay the penalty. So if the penalty is a fine, we call that a sin offering. It's an offering for your sin. So we call it a sin offering. There are 13 of these offerings. You can have a drink offering, a meat offering, a meal offering, a sin offering, a trespass offering. There's 13 of those. We do the same thing today. We have different penalties that we pay for the different grades of crime that we commit. Now, when you pay this fine, you have to have court costs. And in ancient times, when you made a sin offering, you had to have a heave offering. So the heave offering today, called the court costs, goes to the judge's retirement fund. In ancient times, you paid the sin offering. That's a ram of the first year. He cuts off the right front shoulder and sends it off to the higher priesthood. That's their share, their tithe. He keeps the rest of it and divides it up in the local office, the local Levitical priesthood office. The heave offering is the judge's retirement fund, and it is that to this day. If you don't like this process, you could appeal to the Supreme Court. In ancient times, on the Day of Atonement, you took this appeal to the Holy of Holies, where God Almighty Himself, sitting on the mercy seat, would make this decision. And Numbers chapter 36 is an example of one of those judgments. And today we call this the civil service or the judicial system. In ancient times it was called the Levitical priesthood. Then we had the Aaronic priesthood. Today we have the civil service. And we have the state judicial system and we have the federal judicial system. A two-tier, one national and one local. So whether you live in Florida and you go to the local Levites who collect their taxes and tithes and send it up to Tallahassee, or you send your taxes or tithes to the Aaronic priesthood in Washington, D.C. You see, we don't follow the exact principles and the exact practices, but boy, they're close enough for government work, aren't they? Now, we farmers have been violating a number of laws which have brought upon us a number of penalties, and one of the penalties is to be excommunicated, thrown off of the land for breach of contract. It is our violation of the terms and conditions of this old covenant contract located in Exodus 19. All right, hang on. We'll be back with more when we return. Don't go away. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, during World War II, our parents and grandparents planted victory gardens and they help to provide their own food and fiber for themselves and for their country. Well, today, more than half of the food that we now eat in the United States is imported from outside of our borders. Our food is produced from hybrid seed that will not reproduce, and it is nutritionally deficient. Now, Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter into perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients, which are usually added to commercial feeds. And when compared to more than 4,000 samples of hybrid corn tested in 10 Midwest states in a recent year, Steinbrom's open-pollinated corn contained 75% more crude protein, 875% more copper, 345% more iron, 205% more manganese, and the same result has also been seen in the content of calcium, sodium, and magnesium and zinc. Now, in the opinion of many eco-farmers, hybrid seed merely masks poor farming practices by producing bins and bushels of foodless food without the nutrients that are really food's reason for being. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free General Law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free General Law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right. Now, we've been talking about this thing of the USDA. Remember that the base article that we're talking about is called The Agribusiness Examiner, and you can subscribe free of charge. It's email avkrebs@earthlink.net. It's an easy one. A-V-K-R-E-B-S. That's the guy's name, A.V. Krebs. That's A is in Alvin, V is in Victor, Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, @earthlink.net. Just send him your name and address. He'll have to have your name and your email address. I don't know if he sends this out in the mail. I don't think so. I think he just sends this out on the email. And give him your name, address, and probably a phone number or something like that, and I'm sure he'll send you a copy. Now, if you want to subscribe, I suggest, he takes donations. You know, he has to make a living like everybody else. And somebody has to pay him, and I recommend $25 a month. That's $300 a year. It's a newsletter that's published weekly. And boy, is it jam-packed with information. Sometimes you'll have 24 pages. Sometimes 18, it's never the same. It's, you know, anywhere from 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24 pages. Comes out every week, and he puts in the articles that he gleans from all over the country, all over America, from various sources, concerning agriculture and food topics, the kinds of things that we're talking about here this week. Whatever happened to the American farmer? Well, I'm going to carry it a step further. Everybody blames the Republicans, the Democrats, the Jews, the bankers, and everybody else. Let's put the blame where it belongs. It belongs on the shoulders of God Almighty Himself. How do I know that? Well, God took the credit for it, and He told you. He said, here's what I'm going to do. And it's in Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy chapter 28, and the eviction of the farmers from the land, of which I'm one of them, my granddad was one. You know, Americans, at the turn of the century, you know, up until about 1930, 40, along in there, most of us lived on the land. In 1920, half the people in the country, nearly half, not quite, but nearly half the people in the country were living on the land. The other half were working in the cities. Well, my granddad had the Needle Rock Ranch. That was 1,600 acres on the north coast of California in Mendocino County, northern Mendocino County, right above Bear Harbor. And he mortgaged the farm, and he did not practice the agricultural laws, the 15 agricultural laws. Now, he practiced some of them. It wasn't that he didn't practice any, but he didn't practice all of them. and he got evicted from the land. In 1935, when he couldn't meet the mortgage payments, he lost the ranch. Now, under the inheritance law of Moses, if my granddad had obeyed the law, he would have not lost the ranch, and he would have passed that on to my dad. And my dad was the firstborn, and I would have been his firstborn, and I would have inherited the ranch, and then I have a firstborn. And in Exodus chapter 20, God makes this observation. He said, I'm going to visit the sins of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Yeah, my granddad hated God, and so did my dad, and so did I. And I didn't practice this law, and I went into the cattle business in Arcata, California. And you know what happened to me? I went to ag school. I learned all of the modern agricultural laws. I was out there putting chemical fertilizer on the land, sprays and pesticides, and drugs and chemicals, and I got thrown off the land. Just like the other 94% of us that wouldn't practice this law. So one day I took stock of that and I looked around and I said, you know, I wonder if this old Mosaic law has any meaning for the 20th and 21st century. And so I said, well, I think I'll practice this. So I started practicing the law. I've now been reestablished. I'm on the land. I'm not complaining. I make good money on it. And I pay my tithes and I pay all of my dues that I owe God. And it works just like a shot. Works like a shot. The profit margin's great. The fringe benefits are good. And I'm just as happy as a clam at high tide. And so from time to time, I like to come over the air and say, well, let me tell you what my results were. Now, when I practiced commercial agriculture, I lost all of my money, lost my ranch, lost my cattle, lost everything I had. And when I practiced this law, I get it all back. And I got it back in spades. So a lot of times people will say to me, well, this is a very negative law. And it's very restrictive and it's demanding and we don't like it. I don't think so. I think that this law is pretty positive. Let's take a look at the land Sabbath and Jubilee. Have you ever thought about why? You know, why do you have a land Sabbath and a Jubilee? It's very simple. You see, that's the process that we use to fertilize the soil. Let's picture it this way. You know, you've got 160 cows on 160 acres, and you're producing 1,000 gallons of milk a day. Milk weighs 8.7 pounds to the gallon, and it's, 87% water and 13% solids, and it's about 1,000 pounds a day of solids that you're taking off of this land. Those solids are organic material. And how do you replace that organic material in the soil, the nutrients in the soil? Well, you do it by practicing the land Sabbath. Now, if you take a look at the way the buffaloes did it, you know, out in the olden days, well, the buffalo goes out and eats grass. Now, when a cow eats grass today, they eat 35 pounds a day, 60 or 70 pounds of green grass, but 35 pounds of hay. And they convert that into manure. The manure then decomposes into dirt. So a cow is making 35 pounds of dirt a day. Now, if you just take a look at the mechanics of the grass is 90% organic material and 10% inorganic. The carbolic acid in the roots of the grass melts down, decomposes the inorganic rock, sand, and inorganic material, converts it to organic. Trees convert it to wood. Then the termites and the ants break the cellulose down and convert that into organic material in the soil. Soil builds up at the rate of 1 inch every 90 years, about 1 foot every millennium. That's the thing that we call topsoil. Go to Iowa and there's 6 feet of it in places. And well, all that is the grass grows up and dies down, grows up, dies down, grows up and dies down every 90 years, and it adds an inch. You got good, rich, black, organic topsoil. See how simple that is? All right. Now, if once every 7 years you let your land rest, you don't take the corn off of it. You don't take the wheat off of it. You don't take the fruit off of it, the vines, you know, the grapes. You let it die die back, fall on the ground, rot. It feeds the microorganisms in the soil, and it fertilizes the soil. And it keeps the soil in a continuous, top-notch condition so that it produces 24% protein wheat. You know, when our forefathers got out to Illinois, Indiana, the prairie grass was so tall, 10 foot tall, it would hide a man sitting on a horse. In 1916, in Wisconsin, I saw corn stalks 18 feet tall. We don't see that today, and that's because the land today is worn out. Where we've been cropping the land, we wear it out. It has to have a land Sabbath and a jubilee. The gleaning law. You know, God says, I'm going to give you plenty. I'm going to give you an 87,200% return. So I've got to have a system called workfare to feed the poor. I want you to let the poor come out and glean the leftovers on your land. So that's the methodology that God has instituted for welfare, called the gleaning law. Now, you people today have a welfare law, don't you? And so you practice welfare. And I can remember when we were growing potatoes in Eel River Valley, we'd sign a contract with Ego Potato Chips. We'd produce 24 tons to the acre. 12 tons goes to number one and twos for potatoes. 12 tons gets disked into the ground and wasted. Why is that? Because the contract calls for us to disk all of the culls into the ground so that the poor people can't pick them up. And that's so that the poor people can't make potato chips and they'll have to buy Eggo or Bluebird potato chips. Well, gee, we got $3.50 a sack for the potatoes, and then we had to take 50% of that, $1.75, and pay it to taxes so that we could support the people on welfare so that they could get money so that they could come into the store to buy the potato chips. Wouldn't it have been better to just let them come out and pick up the 12 tons on the ground? Keep the whole $3.50? I don't know, boys and girls. Looks like to me that God's got a better plan with a whole lot less work. He only requires a 10% tithe. You know, we're paying 14 taxes that consume up to 76% of everything we create and produce, depending upon how savvy you are on taxes. I don't think these laws are nearly as negative as we give them credit for. And you know who tells us that these laws are negative? It's the preachers, the wolves in sheep's clothing that come into your churches and tell you that the Bible doesn't mean what it says and that it's full of errors and the creation didn't occur in 7 days and or 6 days and Noah's flood didn't exist. The scripture calls those preachers lying prophets and wolves in sheep's clothing. And then the ones that aren't in the ministry are in government. And they're the guys that run the USDA, the FDA, and encourage you to vote. Yeah, they want you to get out and vote and practice democracy, a system of political government that our founding fathers in this country totally abhorred and which is strictly prohibited by Numbers chapter 16. You got to go read Numbers chapter 16. There's your first case in the Bible of a loyal opposition voting. They came to Moses and said, you know, a guy named Korah came up to Moses and said, hey, you take too much upon yourself, sins that were all holy. Yeah. So God said, well, let's have an election. This afternoon we'll have a vote, 2:30 in the afternoon. Moses, you get as far away from that guy as you can get. Ground opened up, killed 14,700 people, including all the women, children, babies, dogs, cats, pigs, cows, sheep, goats. If it breathed, if it moved, it died. The election is over. The results are known. The will of God has clearly been shown. Korah lost the election. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, biotech beans, chemical corn, frankenfish, and the pesticide potato. You know, that's what's on the menu down at your local neighborhood supermarket. And I'm concerned that this technology is a serious threat to your health and mind, and to traditionally bred open pollinated seeds, and to the environment, and to the farmers that grow them. Hey, listen to this quotation. It comes from the Chicago Tribune, and they said, quote, "We are being exposed to one of the largest uncontrolled experiments in history. And in less than 5 years, these companies have flooded the marketplace with thousands of untested and unlabeled products containing foreign genetic material. And these genetically modified organisms pose several real dangers because they have been engineered to create novel proteins that retard spoilage, produce their own pesticides against insects, or allow the plants to tolerate larger and larger doses of weed killers." Unquote. And what is really scary is that this isn't from Tom Clancy's latest thriller. These seeds are already a major part of the U.S. corn and soybean crop. Now, what happens if one of these so-called suicide genes, which prevents seed saving, goes haywire and then destroys the entire U.S. corn crop? Or it turns out that genetically modified rice kills people? Or what if it causes genetic mutations or birth defects in people like thalidomide did back in the 1950s? Well, I don't want to take that risk, and I'll bet you don't want to be a guinea pig in this ill-advised experiment either. Now, if you'd like to know more about this multinational corporate monopoly of our seed and food supplies and how you can become independent from them, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about the 15 agricultural laws of the Bible. I teach these 15 agricultural laws in my $100,000 on 25 acres or less class. I don't see anything that's negative about these laws. They're all positive. Let me show you another one here. Remember this ad that I just read to you? Adolf Steinbrom of Fairbanks, Iowa, put the matter in perspective by having samples of corn tested for nutrients. Well, back in the 1880s in Kansas, the wheat there tested 24% protein. Today, when you tell somebody that, they look at you like you're a liar. We all know that wheat in Kansas tests 7 to 13%. Hey, listen, in 1950 it was still 18%, but you know, we don't practice land Sabbaths or Jubilees, and we're learning how to mine the soil, and we control insects with pesticides, and we grow crops with chemical fertilizers. Well, you know, God gave us the law, and He said, you shall not... let me turn to it over here. It's Leviticus 19. I'm here in Leviticus 26. Let's just back up here a little bit. Leviticus 19:19 says, He says, you shall not sow your field with mingled seed. Now we're not just sowing our fields with mingled seed. We've been using hybridization for about 100 years. But now we're getting into genetic modification. Genetic modification. God told us not to crossbreed our four-footed quadrupeds. That doesn't mean that you can't breed a Jersey and a Holstein cow. Those are dairy cows. What it's talking about here is you can't breed a buffalo with a cow because they're four-footed quadrupeds, and you come up with beefalo or geeps when you breed sheep with goats. That's what violates the law. What do you think Dolly the sheep is? Now, this is being foisted off on us by the multinational corporations like Monsanto and the big colleges and universities, the agricultural schools, the United States Department of Agriculture. They're the ones that are encouraging us to violate these laws of God. And every time we violate one of these laws, we get a penalty. You can't penalize the United States of America. It's a fiction. It's a piece of paper. But you can sure punish the guy that actually does that. And when we farmers go out and we violate these laws, we get a penalty. And that's because there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. Well, this brings us up to a story called The Deacon of St. James. This guy, the Deacon of St. James, was the head Deacon of St. James in London. And that was a pretty prestigious position. The guy was illiterate. He couldn't read and write. I don't remember his name now in the story. It's a true story. And it was about 1760-something or other. And the Episcopal Church of England, it's the Catholic Church, but in England they changed the Catholic Church to the Episcopal Church. Little difference between the two. Anyway, the Episcopal Church of England decided that deacons should be able to read and write. They should be literate. And so they passed out a directive, and it said, you know, in 6 months, all of the deacons of the churches have to be able to read and write. Well, this guy, we'll call him Bob, he couldn't read or write. And he was about 50 years old. Now, he'd been the head deacon of St. James for about 10 years. He'd been a deacon in the church, you know, for many years. But he'd been the head deacon for about 10 years. Did a good job. Nobody complained about his work. So the bishop called him into the office and he said, hey, Bob, if you can't learn to read and write and do it in 6 months, we're going to have to terminate you. Well, old Bob was pretty sad. He went home, told his wife, and sure enough, 6 months later, he was terminated because he couldn't read and write. And he was really dejected, and you can imagine how you'd feel if you were 50 years old and lost your job, been there for 30 years. So he did that. He went home. He told his wife, well, I've been terminated. Today was my last day. And his wife said to him, you know, Bob, you've always wanted to be a tobacconist. A tobacconist. Why don't you take our little meager savings? And he says, oh, Mary, if I take our meager savings and I die or anything happens, you know, what'll become of you? And she says, you know, you've got to take a chance. You've got to go out and do what you want to do in life. And you've always wanted to be a tobacconist, and you couldn't because you were the deacon of St. James. And so he took their little meager savings, and he went down and he bought some supplies, and he rented a little hole-in-the-wall shop on Piccadilly Circus, and he opened up a tobacco store. And lo and behold, the little tobacco shop flourished, and he made a little money off of it. And the following year, he opened a second tobacco store, and then the third year, he opened a third tobacco store, and this went on and on. Pretty soon, he had 14 tobacco stores scattered around London. This is back in the 1760s, you know. Well, he had quite a bit of money, and he didn't know exactly how much. He was illiterate, you know, but he had it in the Bank of England. And so he got a letter one day from the Bank of England. Well, of course, he's illiterate and he couldn't read. So he took it over to a friend of his and he gave it to him. And the friend read it to him. And the letter said that he was not employing his money properly in the bank, that it was not employed properly, and that he should come into the bank and talk about this matter at his earliest convenience. And he didn't quite understand what that meant, and he thought, well, gee, maybe I've done something wrong. He was pretty concerned about it. And so on the date and the time appointed, he went off to the bank to have the meeting, and he sat down with his banker, and his banker brought out his account, and he pointed out that he had £287,000 he deposited in the bank. Now, £287,000 in 1760 was quite a bit of money. Just figuring £5 to the dollar, you know, he had five times that $287,000 in dollars, and those dollars had a lot more purchasing power, you know, 200 years ago than they do today. So he had quite a few millions of dollars in the bank, in today's terms. And the banker handed him the report, and he said, here, look this over. Our conclusion is that your £287,000 on deposit in the bank is drawing only bank rate interest, and it should be more properly employed in other investments. Well, you know, the old deacon of St. James, he wasn't quite sure how it was that he should be investing his money. He didn't know much about investments. And he couldn't read the report anyway. And he looked at it, and the banker said, "Well, what do you think of this report and this proposal that we have for you?" And he couldn't read, so he stalled off the banker as long as he could, and finally he blurted out, he said, "Sir, it is to my shame to be sure, but I can neither read nor write, and I cannot read this report." The banker was just absolutely incredulous. He said, "What? What? You can't read or write?" And the old deacon said, "Well, it's true. I can't read and I can't write. And that's why I deposit my money in the bank, because, you know, I'm really not a real businessman." And he told the banker the story. He told him, "You know, about I used to be the deacon of St. James, and finally, I know I used to be the head deacon of St. James. And when I was the head deacon," he told how the bishop had come to him and told him that the deacons were going to have to learn how to read and write, and if they couldn't read and write, well, they were going to be terminated, and he was going to be out on his ear, and he wasn't going to have his job as the head deacon anymore. And he tried his best. He tried to learn to read and write. He bought books, and he went to people, and he just was too old, and he just could not learn to read and write. So the banker read the report to him, made his suggestions, and so the old deacon said to him, "Well, I don't know what I ought to do." And the banker said, "Well, it's a tragedy that life has dealt you such a cruel blow." He said, "People that have the kind of money that you do, 287,000 pounds, employ their money more profitably and convert their money into more money and double their money and triple their money and quadruple their money, and it's a shame that you've only got 287,000 pounds on deposit in the bank and that you're unable to employ it more profitably because you can't read and write." And the banker finally looked at him and he said, "My God, man, can you imagine where you would be today if you could read and write?" And the old deacon said, "Yes, sir, I can. If I could read and write, I would be the head deacon of St. James." Well, we're about out of time. It's been good being with you this week. You've been listening to the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio logs, our schedule, and archives. And it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.